From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. We mark the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. today with an excerpt from his Other America speech.
Plus, we'll hear from King's youngest daughter, Dr. Bernice King, who was here last month to speak about her father's legacy.
Then Waukesha lawyer Jonathan Fick has won a prestigious short story competition, but he's not ready to write full time.
I know it's the kind of thing that requires an awful lot of hard work and an awful lot of good luck, and I've been given a pretty good step down the pathway, but there's a lot of walking yet to do.
And musician Allison Russell of Birds of Chicago says concerts are like catching lightning in a bottle for the group and its audience.
It's not just passive, you know, it's an exchange, and every show is different because every audience is different.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. 50 years ago today, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. A year prior, in April of 1967, the civil rights icon gave a speech at Stanford University entitled The Other America. King spoke about the many things the civil rights movement was able to accomplish, but the main focus was on the road ahead and the fight for what he called genuine equality.
Although the fight for the Civil Rights Act was not easily won, King believed the battles yet to come would be far more troublesome.
All of these things represented strides, but we must see that the struggle today is much more difficult. It's more difficult today because we are struggling now for genuine equality. And it's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee a livable income and a good solid job. It's much easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee the right to live in sanitary, decent housing conditions. It is much easier to integrate a public park than it is to make genuine quality integrated education a reality. And so today we are struggling for something which says we demand genuine equality.
King goes on to cite troubling statistics about black and white disparities which remained in the United States, like unemployment. In 1967, black unemployment was double the rate of white unemployment, which was significantly worse than it had been just two decades earlier. But in 2018, the disparities are even more staggering.
In the state of Wisconsin, black unemployment is nearly three times as high as white unemployment. The Milwaukee area has the most segregated schools of any metropolitan area in the country. And some say segregation in public schools is just as bad as it was when King gave this speech. Half a century has passed, and we are still struggling with the issues King was trying to combat, the issues he knew would be tremendously difficult to overcome.
Almost a year after the date that speech was given, King was assassinated. His death sparked riots around the country, which we'll hear more about later. But earlier this year, I had the chance to talk to Dr. Bernice King, Martin Luther King Jr.'s youngest daughter. In a conversation on stage at the Pabst Theater, presented by the Jewish Community Center Milwaukee and the Milwaukee Urban League, we talked about her father's legacy, her work, and what life was like after that harrowing day in 1968.
My father was assassinated when I was five. You know, that kind of not only took him out of my life, it kind of repositioned my mother too, because she continued the work and she couldn't be as present as she was prior to his assassination. So it's kind of a displacement of both parents. I don't think people think about that, you know, in this whole process. I grew up where she didn't get an opportunity to come to a lot of my extracurricular activities. I remember some piano recitals, but a lot of the sports that I was involved in, I don't remember my mother ever showing up, maybe for a couple of soccer games. And I played a lot of different sports because she was really focused on advancing the legacy. But in the midst of all of this, You know, we got news at age six that my uncle mysteriously found in his swimming pool dead. He became like a surrogate father for me. He did not drown because he didn't have water in his lungs. He was present when my father was assassinated. We believe there's some connection there to why he's not here with us. At 11 years old, my grandmother was shot in church. So, you know, in a matter of 6 years, I had these three tragic deaths, trying to process through all of that. And in the initial, you know, months after my father was assassinated, my mother brought a psychologist to make sure we were okay, and they thought we were okay. But actually, through Uncle A.D. and then Big Mama, my father's mother, who got killed in church, I wasn't okay emotionally. And, you know, I'll say to this very day, I'm still dealing with some issues because that's a lot of trauma to deal with and not deal with. And I didn't really start seeing counselors until I was in my mid-20s. But the thread of all of the pain and, you know, the abandonment issues, fear, all that stuff coupled together, you know, hurt, loss, everything together ended up sending me through a whole, you know, series of anger, rage, all kind of feelings. And to the point that I went through some years of my life where, and I'm going to say it because I said it to other audience, where I literally, you didn't know it, but I literally hated white people, and especially white males. And, you know, the Lord began to do some things in my life through getting called into ministry, accepting that call, still carrying some of that hate in my heart. And I went on this television show in 2000 with a gentleman who happens to be an evangelical, James Robeson. And in the middle of him interviewing me about, you know, my father, the loss and everything, he said, can I give you a hug? Now, in my heart, I was like, uh-uh. But I had been taught better by my mom, so I just, you know, I said, being cordial, yes. And it was one of the most genuine hugs that I had ever received in my life. And something as simple as that began to turn the tide in my heart. And then, you know, certain things, God would start doing things and highlighting things with white males around me. And I was like, wow. And it gave me a whole different perspective because my hate was in response to my loss. You know, I felt like, you know, white people killed him, not necessarily James or Ray, but that's a whole nother story. You know, I felt like black people weren't doing everything they could do. You know, I was angry at God too, because I felt like he could have stopped it and didn't. So that was the emotional side of growing up. But we grew up very normal. We didn't have bodyguards other than when James and Ray escaped from jail. My mother raised us very normally in Vine City, which is considered, you know, the ghetto. That's where my father chose to live amongst the people, and she remained there up until a year or two before her death. Had friends, you know, ironically, I grew up having a lot of white friends in elementary school because I went to a private school, actually private and a lot of Jewish friends, as a matter of fact. And then I switched over to a public school, predominantly black, where I graduated from. So I had a you know, a normal upbringing, and you know, it's difficult. The difficulty is growing up in a normal way, but being recognized as a part of a royal family. You get a little schizophrenic from time to time because there are many places you go and people are like, "Ah, you're the daughter of," and I'm sitting up like, "And." You know, because my mother just raised us to be normal, you know, down-to-earth, you know, kids and ultimately adults. And so sometimes I walk around like, God, you know, what do I do? I mean, if I try to be normal, people want me to be royal. If I try to be royal, people want to bring me back down to normal. So it's been an interesting journey. But it was fun in our household. We had a lot of fun. My dad used to, you know, my sister said he was her buddy. He used to love to play with us, and because we were like his refuge when, you know, he would come home from everything. And one time they were playing basketball in the house. And of course, you know, my mother cringed because she didn't want any of the dishes broken. But, you know, he was free. So it didn't upset her too much because she wanted him to have that freedom. And he loved to joke. People should know that. Even though you see the serious Martin Luther King, he loved to joke, had a great sense of humor. We had a great house. And I'll be honest, I'm glad we didn't grow up with guns in our house, because the anger that I was carrying around, somebody probably would have been dead, literally.
And you wouldn't be here.
I wouldn't be here. Right.
Bernice King is a minister, an activist, and the youngest daughter of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr., who was assassinated 50 years ago today.
People around the country are celebrating the life and work of Dr. King today in a series of remembrances. Bernice King has a simple request for how people remember her father today. At 6:01 p.m., groups and individuals will be ringing bells to remember the moment her father was struck down. 39 rings for the 39 years of his life.
The timing of King's assassination meant that many people didn't learn about his death until the morning after. But the following week brought chaos to many American cities as frustrated mourners rioted and protested King's untimely death.
For Lake Effect essayist Marnie Mominga, the news set off a series of unforeseeable events in what would have otherwise been a fairly banal spring break in Washington, D.C.
King's been shot, our cabbie announced as my girlfriend and I hopped in a late-night cab to catch our train home. What? I stuttered. Martin Luther King, he's been killed by an assassin, repeated the cabbie to my uncomprehending ears. Up until that moment, we two college freshmen were giddy with excitement to be heading off to our first spring break. While many college students hit the highways leading to sunny beaches and beer parties, we opted to go to Washington, D.C. It wasn't because we shunned such adventures. It was because we were broke. We had met as dishwashers in our dorm's cafeteria, and although we didn't have a dime between us, we just knew part of our college education was to experience spring break, and we could not have been more right. Because my sister lived and worked in D.C., and because we could fly standby for a mere $25, we pooled our dishwasher money and headed east. The date was April 4th, 1968. It was a somber homecoming when we arrived around midnight at my parents' house. Shocked and devastated by King's assassination, we shared what little facts we knew from the few news sources available late at night. At that point, no one could have guessed how King's death would affect the nation. And so, with our parents' blessing, we caught an early morning flight and headed off to the nation's capital. Oh, such freedom! Two 18-year-olds on our first travel adventure alone. Luckily, on that first day, we took in all the sights we could. Walking everywhere, we climbed to the top of the Washington Monument, hiked under the fragrant blossoms of the cherry trees circling the Jefferson Memorial, and rested on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial before heading across the Potomac to the Arlington Cemetery to see the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Finally, exhausted and footsore, we turned around in the late afternoon to hike the several miles back to my sister's. And that's when we saw the city burning. Wow, something big is on fire, I said as huge bellows of black smoke rose from the center of the city. I wonder what it is, answered my friend in amazement. It wasn't until we got closer and I could hear sirens screaming that we knew something was terribly wrong. Where have you been? My sister said, panic in her voice as she greeted us at the door. I've been worried sick about you. Don't you know what's happening? We did not. How could we? We did not own transistor radios, and, of course, this was pre-cell phones. There's rioting in the city and buildings are burning, my sister gasped. They sent us home from work early because the riots are so close. How close? I asked, stunned by this frightening information. The riots are only blocks away from the White House, and we are just six blocks from there. The National Guard has been called in, and a curfew is in effect. Gone was the happy spring break we had set off on. Gone, too, was our youthful innocence. Instead, we found ourselves in the aftermath of a national tragedy. We spent the first few days sequestered in my sister's apartment, watching the news, trying to understand what was happening and when it might end. To pass the time, we read and slept and ate whatever food was left in the cupboards. Patrolling our neighborhood at night, the National Guard sometimes parked their trucks on our street. In the darkness of a curfewed city, we felt a little less afraid with their close presence. And being curious, we often stepped out in the shadows of our second-story balcony to see what was happening. "How's it going?" we called from above. "What are your names and where are you from?" For several nights, we chatted back and forth in the eerie quiet, for like us, they too were young and lonely and eager for conversation and talk of home. But as the riots escalated, we needed to get out of there. Gratefully, my sister had a co-worker who lived farther out and who graciously opened her home to us and to a number of others. We slept on her floor and shared large pots of homemade soup that our host made from whatever food was available. At last, as the riots calmed, we were finally able to catch a plane and fly standby back home. Back in our college dorm, friends eagerly shared their joyous spring break journeys, and we shared ours. Despite the differences in our adventures, however, I would not, in a heartbeat, exchange my experience for theirs. For despite the fear and uncertainty of the situation, I was given a lesson of a lifetime. Trapped in a small apartment, I learned what it was like not to have freedom. Caught in a city shut down by curfews and military, I began to understand the price of peace. And blessed by the kindness of others living side by side in trying times, I discovered how important tolerance was for all. But mostly I learned about the hope that Martin Luther King Jr. spoke so eloquently about in his final speech before his death. The hope he never gave up on. Hope for the violence to end. Hope for justice to prevail. Hope for all of us to love our neighbors as ourselves. 50 years later, I am still hoping, and so is our nation.
Marnie Maminga is a regular contributor to Lake Effect. You can read her full essay at WUWM.com.
We'll take a short break and then meet a Waukesha lawyer who's won a prestigious science fiction short story competition. That comes your way when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Fans of science fiction and fantasy literature often have a fantasy of their own, writing the next Fahrenheit 451 or Dune. But not very many fans have the skill or luck to get published.
Jonathan Fick has both. The Waukesha resident is a lawyer by day, but he's been writing genre fiction for some time, and this year he struck pay dirt. His short story, The Howler on the Sales Floor, won the Los Angeles-based Writers of the Future contest and will be published in an anthology this month. He joins me in the studio now. Jonathan, it is a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
This is a very exciting time. Your short story, The Howler on the Sales Floor, has won a very big competition in the sci-fi and fantasy world. First of all, tell me about how you found out about the competition in the first place, and then we'll talk about the story.
There's a writer who's wildly successful named Brandon Sanderson, who lives in Utah and occasionally teaches a class at BYU about being a creative writer, specifically within genre fiction, and he put his lectures on YouTube. Somebody he had as a guest on that lecture series identified this contest and said, if you're trying to break in, you should submit to this contest, which runs quarterly. You should submit every quarter because either you'll win or eventually you'll have sold enough stories to be ineligible, and he'll have sort of won in a different manner of speaking. And that gentleman's name is Eric James Stone. He's a past winner as well, and that's how he kind of got his start. So I found out through the internet community of people who, you know, trying to provide resources for people who are aspiring genre writers. And I thought to myself, well, I don't have anything to lose. It doesn't cost anything to enter, so I'll try submitting to the contest. So I submitted something that I didn't really have particularly high hopes for, and it received an honorable mention, which some back of the napkin math suggests is about the top 10% of submissions. They're sort of opaque about the numbers. So I suddenly was rather encouraged. And so I thought, oh, I can do this. And so I wrote another something and I sent it off and it got rejected. So I was promptly given a wonderful lesson in humility. And I kind of kept going on that
road. And when was that? How long have you been doing this?
I think this was the sixth thing that I submitted. It was either the fifth or the sixth thing that I submitted. So about a year and a half worth of kind of trying at this operation. I know there are people out there who've been submitting for much longer than I, and some people who, you know, went on their first, you know, go round. So I don't know where I fall on the bell curve, so to speak. But, you know, I eventually managed to sneak this one over the finish line.
Well, I want to say that I enjoyed the story thoroughly, and it is incredibly funny.
Thank you. That was the goal. I was trying to be humorous. I think a lot of people try for dramatic, and in genre fiction especially, many of us kind of grow up reading stories that were the fate of the world or the universe or someone's soul is at stake. And I sort of went the exact opposite route and went really small. And it takes place in a very small setting when the stakes are comparatively quite small. And I also think that we culturally and have a tendency to dwell on things that are not as fun right now. And trying to take a step back and interject some levity into people's entertainment, I think, has some value. We don't need another dystopian fiction. There's quite a few of them out there. So I thought if I could make people laugh for a few thousand words, that might be a decent strategy. And it appears to have worked. And you said it was funny. So I guess I managed that goal.
I have to say, it reminded me in a lot of ways of Terry Pratchett's fiction, where you're dealing with big themes, but in a very small, quotidian way, and with huge, huge things happening underneath, but it's all about, you know, did the paper order come through, and are we going to play softball after work?
Right. And I think that, you know, some of the effectiveness or part of what I was trying to achieve was absurdity in contrast, where you have, like you said, I mean, I feel like Terry Pratchett does this probably better than anybody who has ever tried, where the event might be small, but it's sort of absurd in the way that he's, you know, trying to get at the underlying ideas. And so here we have, you know, somebody who's, you know, driven into anger by the act of somebody not refilling a coffee pot in the office when the coffee pot is empty.
And we all know what that feels like.
And that's the goal. That was sort of the idea, is to try to frame in sort of the idea behind what's going on and something that's very relatable. And also have the outsized reactions or the contemplated outsized reactions seem so out of sync with the coffee pot is not full, to try to, you know, drive home that comparison.
So what do you, other than winning, which, by the way, congratulations, that's a terrific thing, but you're also going to get to go to Hollywood, not only to attend the awards ceremony, but don't you have a week of, like, or at least a few days of working with people and kind of like a workshop?
It is a workshop. So David Farland is the coordinating judge. He's, if you want to think of him as the editor-in-chief of the anthology. He's been sort of a lifer in the genre fiction landscape. He's been around for a long time. I don't know his entire bio, but he also, in addition to being a best-selling author, has a pretty sizable sideline business of being an educator. He runs writing conferences all over the world. He publishes how-to type of stuff. And in addition to also being the coordinating judge for this anthology. So we're there from, I think it's April 3rd to April 10th. And he runs a, you know, writing workshop with other best-selling authors who have established themselves in the business and are going to pass along their, I guess, wisdom and observations.
It'll be fun and a chance to rub shoulders with all these folks.
Yeah, absolutely. And the only reason I kind of came into this sort of thing is because I had been a fan of the genre and of fiction since time immemorial. So if I'm getting to rub shoulders with people who I've, you know, whose work I've read over and over again, it would be, you know, quite an experience, and certainly one that I'm unlikely to be able to duplicate anytime soon. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Now, is there any idea in your mind that you would like to replace being a lawyer with being a full-time writer? Or is this always going to be more of a hobby thing for you?
I think that that would be really humbling, and it certainly sounds like it would be really great. I think that one of the truths of more or less any occupation is what it looks like from the outside tends to not be quite what it looks like on the inside. And so, you know, from my perspective now, it sure sounds like it's better than being a lawyer. And I suspect that many of your listeners would agree. You know, lawyers don't have the most romantic reputation. And it is something that I love to do. So if you can, you know, make a living doing what you love, that obviously, you know, sounds pretty good. I know it's the kind of thing that requires an awful lot of hard work and an awful lot of good luck. And I've been given a pretty good, you know, step down the pathway, but there's a lot of walking yet to do in order to come anywhere close to replacing my day job, so to speak, with writing. But it is, you know, it's the kind of thing that makes for good daydreams, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And more short stories. Have you ever done a novel, or are you more happy in the short story realm?
Quite the opposite, actually. I had never written anything in short fiction prior to the contest. It doesn't mean that I've successfully written anything much longer that's very good, but I had always tried to work on longer works and find myself more naturally gravitating towards that form. I think it's always probably because it's what I've always read. Short fiction doesn't get as wide of a readership, and it's much more of a niche product. And there are great publications that put astounding work out on a monthly or quarterly basis, and it's very difficult to break into those. But and I can keep trying to do so, but I think that I would more naturally try to work on longer stuff. You know, I think that there's it just sort of suits me a little bit better. There's more time to develop a lot of the things that you think of, you know, wanting to get into character and place and playing with the ideas that are at the root of genre. I think you can get a really, really quick punch out of short fiction, but you can kind of play with nuance a lot more with more words. And so that's what I've always sort of more naturally done.
But here you are winning a short fiction, which is terrific. So maybe there's a newfound appreciation for that particular form.
Oh, there is. And it's much more difficult than I think that from the outside, you could say, oh, well, if a novel is 80,000 words and a short story is 2,000 words, well, it must be, you know, orders of magnitude easier to write something that's, you know, only 2,000 words. And yet it's almost more difficult because you have to do things differently. You need to be more dense with every word needs to do more things, because you have to establish a setting and establish characters, make people care about those characters and have them do something, you know, have a goal, fail to meet that goal, achieve that goal, all the things that go into story. And now you don't have any extra words to play with. You have to be extremely efficient with your prose. And it's really hard to go from writing something that's long to writing something that's short. I mean, I would suspect that it's kind of like saying that, oh, I'm a painter, but I'm just going to make this sculpture over here, this, you know, piece of pottery or something. The medium is different, and so the things, the challenges associated with it are different. And it took time for me to figure out how to work within a shorter environment. And I'm
Will
still
you do more?
I think so. Yes,
yeah.
And I've submitted a few other things, and had one accepted, and there's waiting on a few, and have been rejected a few times. And it is a good way to exercise writing muscles that are certainly useful in longer forms. And it's fun because it's the kind of thing that you can finish in a shorter period of time, whereas, you know, undertaking something that's, you know, 60, 80, 100,000 words takes, you know, weeks and months and longer.
Sometimes years.
For some people, yeah.
Yes.
That to be able to finish something and say, oh, this is done, you know, in a period measured in days has its own benefit, because there is a value and an achievement in looking down on something and saying it's done. You know, the words, the end, are sort of powerful that way. And it's much easier to put out a volume of work if the length of each individual piece is much shorter.
So my understanding is that this is going to be published sometime this month, and so everyone will have the opportunity to pick that up and read it with Jonathan Fick. It has been such a pleasure, A, to have read the story. It is really wonderful. And thank you so much for coming in and talking about it.
Absolutely. Thanks again for having me.
Waukesha resident and lawyer Jonathan Fick's short story, The Howler on the Sales Floor, is published by Galaxy Press in the anthology L. Ron Hubbard Presents Writers of the Future, Volume 34.
Fick is currently in Los Angeles to participate in the week-long writing workshop. The awards ceremony will be held on Sunday. There's more information about the contest at WUWM.com.
Coming up, the Birds of Chicago return to the Lake Effect studio with a preview of their new album, Love in Wartime. That's when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Lord, let me die before my child. Every mother, far and wide, that's a super love. I'm a super lover. You can feel it near and far. It fades the moon and blinds the stars. That's a super love. Are you a super lover of the night? So cold. Among us dreams the dawn. Who could count?
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. They're called Birds of Chicago, but there's a lot of geography in the group, led by Allison Russell and J.T. Nero. Russell is a Montreal native. The couple lives in Nashville, and they are honorary Milwaukeeans. J.T.'s family lives here, and they spend plenty of time right around here.
Plenty of time includes a concert earlier this year, opening for Valerie June, and one they'll headline this Friday at the Collectivo Backroom. They were back in town between those dates as well, and we were fortunate enough to have them stop by, chat with Mitch Tyke, and play a song from the album coming out this spring. The album is called Love in Wartime, and here is Super Lover.
Believe what you will, believe they're gonna tell you. It's naive to be a super lover. Are you a super lover? There's no God of fire and blood. If there's a God, then God is love. We need a super lover. We need a super lover of the night. So cold. Who among us dreams the dawn? Who could count the flowers in your rage, tears of grief from Inglewood to Nairobi. We need a super love, need a super lover.
Super lover. Birds of Chicago, JT, Allie, JT, I'm pointing at the wrong person at the wrong time. Thanks. It was wonderful.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah,
back on the show.
Back. It's a thrill to have you back here, and an exciting time, too, because the new record is almost out.
Almost out, yep. Just a few, couple more weeks. Yeah.
In comparison to what you've done in the studio before, how difficult was this record to make?
Well, it happened quickly, and the recording part of it was quick. We started in January at Electrical Audio, which is Steve Albini's studio in Chicago, and we had a little four-day window, and our friend Luther Dickinson, who at the time was on the road with his band, the North Mississippi All-Stars, they were on the Tedeschi Trucks Rolling Soul Review, and they had a several-night stand at the Chicago Theater, and they played the first night of it, and then he had three nights off, so he came and joined us, co-producing the record with JT, and it was so lovely and painless. We just kind of Electrical Audio Studio A is just a great live room. So we were able to record all the songs where we could see each other and playing all together. And it was great. It was really relaxed and wonderful. And having Luther's outside ears was so helpful to kind of know, okay, we've got the take, move on.
There's a certain spontaneity that encourages.
I think so. And I think you get that feeling of that we love of people, you know, really playing music together in a room, which is what was happening.
And then the record deal happened.
Yes, later. So then you make the record and then you sort of figure out how to release it into the world and what partnerships are you going to form to do that. And we wound up working with a wonderful small but mighty label out of Northampton, Massachusetts called Signature Sounds Recordings. And they're lovely. Jim Olson and the team there are just fabulous. We'd worked with them several times as promoters. They do a festival called the Green River Music Fest, and they present shows at the Academy of Music Theater in Northampton as well as the Parlor Room. And we had worked with them in all these different venues and loved them. And so it just was it became a natural progression to then work with them as our label as well.
Yeah, they're good. They're good folks. I mean, they're pretty forward thinking, and they're super, super committed to the music. So it was easy for us.
Well, and it's weird times in the recording industry these days, but I wonder if we're almost at the point where weird is the new normal.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and if weird means way fewer people buying albums, then yes, I think that is the new normal.
They support in other ways, hopefully.
But it's, you know, it's, I mean, she referenced, you know, live music is sort of, you know, if you're a band and you want to make a career out of it, you better be comfortable with playing a lot of live shows. Our whole thing has always been, you know, we're not just trying to make CDs and sell them, and we want to kind of create a culture around the band and the music, and that has its own momentum and sustains and they get that kind of intuitively. We didn't have to explain that to them, so that it feels good.
When you talk about creating a culture around a band, is that the idea that, you know, the fans of your fans or the fans of whatever band really want to be at the show because that's the night that you'll catch lightning in a bottle?
That's the hope, yeah. And people
catch something in a bottle.
Create, well, just that sense of community and communion. I mean, we often talk about that. There's a reason that we don't just sort of sit in our basement and play songs. You know, we feel this compulsion and drive to share music with other people. And it's not just, it's not passive, you know, it's an exchange. And every show is different because every audience is different. And when you get that connection and that sense of communion, I mean, that we're totally hooked on that. And I think maybe for some people, maybe they get that feeling from going to church or synagogue or temple or mosque. But for us, playing shows and connecting with our bandmates musically and intuitively and with the audience, it's a shared experience that we crave sort of on a spiritual reaffirming our common humanity kind of level. So, yeah, it's, I mean, and all that sounds kind of heavy, and I don't mean, we want it to just be also for an hour or two where people can lay aside cares and worries of the day and where all kinds of people with all kinds of different belief systems can be united together enjoying themselves.
And loving us.
I didn't mean it quite like that.
Well, but it strikes me that that's one of the underrated things about going to a concert is you don't even realize it until after it's happened that for the 2 hours or the 2.5 hours, however long you're in the venue, like time is suspended for time. Like you leave it and you've almost been in kind of this time warp for the time you've been inside the auditorium.
Yeah, and it can be so magical. I mean, I feel that way about shows. We got to the last time we played in Milwaukee was opening for Valerie June at the Pabst Theater, and it was we were with her on a 5-night run, and it was a really magical thing to get to open for her and to share her audience with us in the way that she did. But she's also just such a magical performer. I mean, so I had that sense every night of just like, we're so lucky to be here, and feeling, as you say, time suspended, and it's sort of a magical alchemy that occurs when you're at a really great show.
Well, I feel like we should hear another song,
sure.
Either from this new album or the new album that came out shortly before this new album came out.
Our first Signature Sounds release was actually an EP called American Flowers that we put out around Thanksgiving 2017. And six songs, and we did them one day at our friend Steve Dawson's studio. He's a fellow Canadian, and he's got a studio in Nashville called The Hen House. And he has a wonderful podcast as well called Music Makers and Soul Shakers. And I've been personally looking up to him as a musician since I was 17 years old. So it's been lovely to start working with him more. And we just had a day. It was Record Store Day and Earth Day, April, I think, 22nd in 2017 that we recorded this. And
it's a lot of pressure on a recording on those 2 days.
It felt like a good conjunction. It was like, oh, this is fun.
It's been only digital. So available up to this point, but it's actually about to exist in the real world.
That's right.
So,
yeah,
we might have some in Milwaukee when we're here.
We will. Yes.
When you're here the next time, because we talk, you are here.
Yes. Yeah. When we're here the next time.
Good point.
When we're here the next time, we'll have some.
So, with that in mind, what are you going to play for us?
It's called "All Right, All Right." It's the first song off American Flowers.
This is not a song for your carnival of fear. I don't need to see myself in your funhouse mirror. This is just a song for I am in love. Are you tired dreamers in the bloodshot eyes? Never evermore, said the raven. The phoenix and man, give it one more try. Shadow recognize shadow. I better recognize loud. We're all right. Yeah, we're all right. The kids are all right. Yeah, they're all right. And mama, hey, pop, get your mind.
All right, all right. From American Flowers, Birds of Chicago, thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mitch.
How would you compare the vibe of American Flowers to the vibe of Love and Wartime?
You know, Love and Wartime, when we finished the last studio record, Rio Midnight, which was in some ways sort of a somber piece for us, or kind of a melancholy suite. We just had sort of a real urge to make a rock and roll record, and I feel like Love and Wartime, I mean, we have a pretty big tent in general of what we consider to be rock and roll, but it is definitely, it rocks a little bit harder and has a little more of a kind of a sprawling energy to it. And, you know, we knew that on a musical level that's what we wanted to do. And then that kind of just dovetailed energetically, you know, with sort of the trauma of sort of like the last year and a half in terms of our culture and the way people have been feeling. You know, I think we felt all the more committed that was the right move. You know, we needed a little injection of some rock and roll.
Almost a catharsis.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and we're wrestling with, you know, the same shadows and light that we always wrestle with, but we wanted to do it in a little more grooving way. Mm-hmm. And American Flowers was just a few songs that sort of came along around the same time, but just they sort of felt like sort of like the country cousins they were just softer, and they felt woodsier, and they clearly kind of like put themselves over in a room by themselves, and so you know it's the vibe is, I mean, it's a full-on acoustic record and the songs lend themselves to that, but there's also a lot of similarities, you know,
like, I mean, we're thematic similarities,
the things that we're, you know, wrestling with and navigating came out of the same heart space in the same time. So
that's kind of the beauty of music, though, that they can both come out of that, yeah, that same headspace, but they can sound completely different.
Yeah. Yep.
Indeed.
Well, and you are a bi-national couple here.
Yes.
You know, how do you see your sort of collective identity when it comes to, you know, you're talking about sort of the trauma, you know, many people in this country, yes, have been feeling, regardless of political affiliation, yeah, over the last year and a half. How do you come at that as Canadian and American?
You know, well, I know. First of all, we're in kind of undiscovered country, because I think we are the first Canadian and American to actually legally marry, and that's exciting.
That's not true.
Well, she's thrown a lot in a bit with us. She's got a green card, so.
Yeah, I do. I'm still a Canadian citizen, though. We consider ourselves, I don't know, Scottish, Grenadian, Canadian, Irish, American band.
and you know, I mean,
citizens of the world.
I don't think really, I mean, they're obviously two nations that have their own sets of problems and own identities, but we certainly, our deals bleed into each other.
Yeah,
so
we're very linked.
They're not unaware, and they don't, it's not like they don't feel, you know, the vibe that we're putting out.
I guess we're always trying to write toward and sing about the things that unite us all, you know?
That's why it's shadows and light and not shadows,
yeah,
or light.
That's,
yeah,
right.
It's both. It's,
that's
always
right,
both. Yeah.
And at the same time, having a 4-year-old along for the ride,
yes,
has to add a lot, you know, more light than shadows, I would,
yeah,
think.
Yeah, it's both. Well, it's both. There's that deep, you know, the other, I think on Real Midnight, we were really exploring that we were becoming parents for the first time, and there was this great joy, but also an equally great terror and fear and, you know, uncertainty, and having to live with that and accept that we all, you know, and of course you want to protect your children and we want to keep them safe and with the best will in the world. Sometimes that's out of our hands. And that's tough to, you know, face every day when you look at that little face that you love so much and you just think, I never want anything bad to happen to you. And it's gonna, you know, inevitably. So,
but then she can write about it.
Yeah. She's already, she just has started to write recently. I mean, write, not,
right, right.
Not, I don't mean penmanship, but she started to freestyle songs. When her dad or I are practicing, you know, guitar, banjo, she'll just start to like free associate and sing these little pieces. I mean, she's really starting to process the world through words and song, and it's really amazing to watch it as parents. I mean, who knows if that's something she'll keep up, but it's something she's into doing right now. So, yeah, it's been pretty great.
We don't want to force her, but we want her to see that she can have so much fun and make a tremendous amount of money.
Honey, you too can be a folk singer.
So, you know, but you just show her those things, and then maybe she'll follow that path.
I know.
Well, I'm thrilled that you have it as a creative outlet.
We are too.
And that you made some time for us.
It's really a pleasure.
Just a thrill to see you again.
It's always a pleasure to come and chat with you, Mitch. Yeah, it really is.
And could you grace us with one more song?
Yes.
Yeah, we'll do American Flowers. I've seen American flowers all across this land, from the banks of the Shenandoah along the Rio Grande. Do not fear the winter blowing in the hearts of men. I've seen American flowers, they will bloom again. On the south side of Chicago, man who's not yet grown went out for a ride, but the car was not his own.
J.T. Nero and Allison Russell are the driving forces behind Birds of Chicago. They spoke with Mitch Tyke.
Birds of Chicago plays a show this Friday evening at the Colectivo Backroom. Their new album, Love in Wartime, is due out this spring as well. Jason Reavy engineered our in-studio session. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.
I've seen American flowers all across this land, from the banks of the Shenandoah along the Rio Grande. Do not fear the winter blowing in the hearts of men. I've seen American flowers, they will bloom again. Tender was the night down in the Tenderloin, in an alley off O'Farrell Street, in the neon glow. But she finally caught that dragon a mile from Chinatown. She took her wings and eased her body down.